From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Greece, a country with no good choices. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. One Greek writer says if you have to choose between death and a bailout, you choose the bailout, but that doesn't mean that life will get any better. As Greece accepts its second massive loan from other Eurozone countries, there are widespread predictions that things will only get worse. New austerity measures are more likely to increase unemployment and decrease pensions and public services than they are to produce economic recovery. Today we'll hear why so many Greeks are leaving the country and why its problems are so dangerous for the rest of Europe and the United States. On Reporter's Notebook later on, GOP candidates and threats of war on Iran. First, here's the news.
Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. To get a bailout from the rest of Europe, Greece will impose more austerity measures, the kind that led to riots and burning in Athens just last week. Will there be economic recovery or pain with no gain? Why is it so important to the United States? On Reporter's Notebook, except for Ron Paul, all the GOP candidates last night threatened force to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. How does that fit into the campaign against President Obama? We'll talk about that. First, this news update. The UN investigation, UN investigators, I should say, have a confidential list of top Syrian officials suspected of ordering crimes against humanity. They include murder, abductions, and torture. The list has been given to the United Nations for possible future prosecution. Mark Leon Goldberg writes for the UN and global affairs blog UN Dispatch. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
Is this an unprecedented thing to do? Is this something designed to exert more pressure on those individuals that are going to be listed?
This is actually precedented, this sort of process where the UN Human Rights Council asks investigators to investigate human rights abuses, and then these investigators put forward names of people suspected of abuse to UN authorities. That's happened before. I guess the challenge now is that these names right now are sitting in a sealed envelope on the desk of the top UN human rights official, but there's really nothing she can do with these names absent the Security Council enforcing some sort of sanctions against them or the Security Council approving an international criminal court investigation into the crimes in Syria. But so far, that's unlikely to happen as long as Russia, which has a veto on the Security Council, is content to back the Assad regime.
Has Russia indicated any change in that position?
No. The short answer is no. They so far have sort of bucked the international trend about, you know, that you have all of the Western countries, all of the Arab League, most of Syria's neighbors, with the exception of Iran, are all coalescing against Assad. But so far, Russia has stuck by his side and is defending his regime's interests in the Security Council.
So the UN Human Rights Council then can't go directly to the International Criminal Court at The Hague.
No, the Syria is not a member of the International Criminal Court, and so the only way that the ICC can investigate crimes there is if the Security Council grants the court jurisdiction to investigate in Syria, and that requires a vote. But at this time, it looks like Russia would veto that. Now, the other option are sanctions against these individuals' names. An asset freeze and a travel ban. But again, this requires a Security Council vote, and Russia has been unwilling to accede to these kind of pressures, as has China.
Should point out that the shelling continues. It's the 20th day of attacks on the city of Homs, and the atrocities being committed by the government army in Syria are still continuing. You have reported today that there's some word that the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has asked his predecessor, the former Secretary General Kofi Annan, to serve as a kind of special envoy to Syria. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So it was actually CNN's Hala Gharani who reported this in a tweet that she had from senior sources, sort of said that Kofi Annan would be this joint UN Arab League envoy to Syria, and his name has been circulated for a while, so it hasn't been confirmed yet, but I expect we'll know for sure pretty soon. And that would be, you know, it would be an important step forward, but his task, or whoever this envoy's task, it would be really daunting, if not near impossible. Basically, they have two things to do. The first is to secure some sort of humanitarian access to these besieged cities to get medicine in and the wounded out, and that requires some sort of ceasefire. The second, more daunting task is securing some sort of political resolution to this crisis. And again, any envoy's job is going to be made difficult if they don't have the backing of Russia in particular, because, you know, Syria could simply refuse to meet Kofi Annan. They could refuse to give him visas, and there won't be much consequence to Syria for doing so. Really, they need the pressure needs to be applied on Russia, most importantly.
And why is Russia so important to Syria?
They have a naval base. That's an important strategic naval base that so far they seem to be backing the Assad regime and not really hedging between the fact that this regime may fall pretty soon, and maybe they want to spread their bets around. Maybe they want to support, not be so in the corner of this one particular man, but try to look at other options for the future. But so far, they seem to be very firmly in the corner of Assad.
Okay. Once again, the shelling of Homs continues and other actions against the Syrian people by its own government, and it's proving very difficult for the international community to do anything about it. Again, Mark Leon Goldberg is writing for the UN and global affairs blog UN Dispatch. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Hey, thank you, Warren.
In a moment, Greece, a country with no good choices. To the point.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warman Olney back with To The Point. With a show of hands in an almost empty chamber, the Greek parliament today accepted a bailout of 107 billion euros. It also approved a 53% haircut for private bondholders. The package is expected to mean a fifth year of recession, but the finance minister, Evangelos Venizelos, said it was either sacrifice with prospects or complete destruction with no prospects. Nick Malkousis is deputy editor of the English edition of the national newspaper, Katamerini. He also blogs at Inside Greece. Good to have you back on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Warren. Good to be back with you.
Give us a little bit of a little bit more understanding of exactly what it is that the parliament has accepted and what more process needs to be gone through between now and March 20th.
Well, Greece has to pass a range of measures and a series of legislation in the next few days that basically shows to the Eurozone and the IMF its commitment to pushing through with the structural reforms and the austerity measures that those two lenders have asked of Greece in order to qualify for the bailout you've mentioned. The other part of the deal is the haircut for private bondholders, and Greece will make a formal offer to these bondholders tomorrow and will say we are opening the period for a voluntary agreement. We want a 53.5% reduction in the face value, although that will, in effect, the bondholders will lose much more than that in order to reduce our debt. And this all has to happen over the next couple of weeks, as you mentioned, because Greece has two bonds maturing on March the 20th worth 14 billion euros. And if this isn't all pushed through by then, it simply won't have the money to pay them.
What if the private bondholders don't go along with the deal?
Well, if the private bondholders don't go along with the deal, what the Greek government has done effectively with the legislation today is to pass what are called collective action clauses, which means that if there is a majority decision and not all the bondholders go through, then the majority decision will apply to the others who are holding out. So, in effect, it's saying to private bondholders, take the offer now, because the one you may get afterwards won't be as good.
What about the austerity measures? What do they involve on top of the austerity measures that have already been approved and implemented?
Well, Yes, you're absolutely right. Greece has been through over 2 years of austerity now, and that won't change. In fact, it's getting even harsher this year for many Greeks. This package has a number of very controversial items in it, including the reduction of workplaces in the public sector by about 150,000. And currently there are about 800,000, just under 800,000 people employed in Greece's civil service. So that's a huge reduction, and that's going to start in June. Another very controversial term in this part of the bailout is a 22% reduction to the minimum wage in the private sector. And this, although only part of Greece's workforce, less than a third, is on the minimum wage, this is expected to work its way through the system and bring wages down. The Eurozone and the IMF in particular think Greece needs to become more competitive, not just in the European economy, but in the international economy, that its wages are too high in terms of where the economy is, what it produces. And by reducing wages, that may help make its goods cheaper, make it cheaper for tourists to come to Greece, and that way give its economy a kickstart. And this is really the underlying problem, that Greece's economy, as you mentioned, is heading for a fifth year of recession. It contracted by almost 7% last year and is on course to complete the biggest contraction, the biggest recession that we've seen in the developed world, certainly over the last few decades.
What about pensions?
Well, the atmosphere is very, very tense, both in a political sense and in a social sense. In the political sense, Greece is probably heading for snap elections in April, and we're heading for a scenario that Greece hasn't lived through before, which is that neither of its two main parties, PASOK, the centre-left, and New Democracy, the centre-right, will have a clear majority in Parliament. It's quite likely, almost certain, in fact, that they'll have to work together, and it's possible they may even need a third party to work with them. And Greece has a very brief and unproductive history of coalition governments. In a social sense, we're seeing protests all the time, some smaller, some bigger, but the austerity measures, the recession is really biting, and people are feeling it. Unemployment is at over 20%. It's almost at 50% for young Greeks, and this is having an impact. A lot of people are turning against the EU IMF bailout and the terms that it comes with. We've seen a rise of support for the leftist parties in particular, and Greece is going through a very, very tough time in general.
But the finance minister says it's either sacrifice with prospects or complete destruction with no prospects. What does complete destruction mean?
Well, the nightmare scenario for many people is that if Greece either doesn't grab this opportunity, or if we get into the bailout and then within a few months Europe decides that it's had enough of foot dragging over structural reforms, that Greece isn't meeting its targets, and pulls out of the deal and essentially lets Greece go bankrupt, then it's quite likely that the country will have to revert to the drachma, and that will bring it with it a lot of pain, perhaps much more than Greeks are feeling at the moment. It will cause all kinds of problems in the internal market. It will make it very difficult for Greece to have the fuel, for instance, that it needs, because it will have to devalue its currencies. It will cause huge problems in the local banking sector. There's a fear that the banks would collapse. So that's really what he means. Now, of course, the people on the other side feel that is a bit of scaremongering, that really Europe can't let Greece go, because then this may have a knock-on effect in the rest of Europe, and countries like Portugal, perhaps even Spain, could face problems afterwards. But I think the general consensus is that Europe has spent the last few months, especially because of the funding that the European Central Bank has provided for banks in various countries, protecting itself from the effects of a Greek collapse, a Greek bankruptcy. And that's something that's putting fear into Greek politicians, that the Europeans and the IMF may at some point say, well, we've had enough, we're taking the risk and we're letting Greece go.
Nick Malakoutsis with the English edition of Katamerini, National Greek English Language Newspaper. We'll come back to him in a moment, and we'll talk more about international economics as well. First, here's Russell Shorto. He's director of the John Adams Institute in Amsterdam and a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. His article, The Way Greeks Live Now, ran in the magazine on February 19th. He's talked about it briefly on our program before. Now he's back to talk and tell us more. Russell Shorto, good to have you with us.
Hi, Warren. Nice to be with you again.
You toured Greece. You talked to a lot of people about the consequences of 4 years of recession and a 7% decline in the economy just last year, 20% unemployment nationwide, 50% among young people. Tell us about some of the people you talked to and how they're reacting to this.
Yeah, you know, what's striking is, what was striking to me after the article appeared, the comments that it got from, by and large, non-Greeks. And it was an article about sort of ordinary people and how they're struggling, how they're living. And there was, I was impressed by how much anger there was in the comments directed toward ordinary Greeks. So there seems to be a perception that all of this is a result of sort of people living high on the hog and that sort of thing, which, from what I discovered, is certainly not the case. There is systemic issues in all of this, and you could say, as many Greeks said to me, that the problems are our governments and our banks and so on, and therefore ultimately ours because we voted for the people in the government. But the ordinary people really seem to be caught in the middle. So what's going on with the austerity is, over the past 2 years, there have been series of cuts. 2010, they got their income tax, and then to make up shortfalls, the government essentially taxed the people again. And then when too many people did not pay, the government put in a new tax, invented a new tax, which they tagged onto the electricity bills with the caveat that if you didn't pay, they'd shut off your electricity. And we're talking about people who, you know, maybe they started a couple of years ago, they were making 1,300, 1,400 euros a month, so maybe $1,600, $1,700 a month, and now that's down to 900. So it wasn't the case that these are people who were, you know, had lush lives, and now they're struggling a bit. And I found that, you know, with construction workers, with policemen, with farmers, it was a very similar story.
You describe sitting in a cafe, outdoor cafe, one of those wonderful cafes in Athens with a banker. Or excuse me, maybe you were in another city, I can't remember. But in any case, a man walked by and asked if he could have the biscuit that she was given with her coffee.
I asked a Greek banker in the northern part of Greece. I was talking about some actual success stories because I think that's an interesting part of this. I talked to some people who are doing reasonably well in Greece and are in the face of all of this, in the face of the crisis. I think that's an interesting wrinkle to for people to be aware of. And then I kind of put this to her, to this banker, and I said, what about that? And she said, those are very nice stories, and I'm glad to hear it. But, she said, and then she told me this story where she had just been sitting in a cafe outside, and a man came up, a Greek man, well-dressed, and he, you know, with the coffee, they give you a little cookie on the side, and he asked if he could have the cookie. And she said, that is Greece, and that, if you come back a year from now, you're going to see a lot more of.
To what extent did you find that people are leaving the country?
People are leaving the country in waves. Young people are leaving. So many Greeks I talked to said what they're particularly dismayed about is the fact that young people are leaving, and it's as opposed to, say, after World War II when it was a great migration, it's very well-educated young people who are leaving. And because what's troubling about that is if the future doctors and teachers and engineers are leaving, you're talking about a decade down the road, the erosion of the society itself.
Let me go back to Nick Malakoutsis again with Katamerini. Russell Shorto came in as an observer, a reporter, and wrote these stories we've heard and others as well. Did you find that the article was accurate?
Yes, I did. Here in Greece, we got a lot of positive comments because Greeks feel that their story isn't being told, or at least isn't being told fairly or properly. And what we've seen, certainly since the initial stage of the crisis, the first few months, the first year or so, the public discourse was very much about the lazy Greeks, the tax-evading Greeks, the Greeks who are cheating, the Greeks who didn't lie about their statistics, the Greeks who are having very comfortable lives. And I think when people like Russell and other very experienced and able journalists have come here and they've really delved beneath the surface, they see that the reality is slightly different. That's not to say there aren't elements of Greek society or groups within Greek society that have done things the way they shouldn't be done. Clearly that's happened, because otherwise perhaps Greece wouldn't have ended up here. But there is a majority, and I firmly believe it's a majority, that are hardworking, that pay their taxes, that are progressive, that want to work and do work hard, that run businesses, that look to build the economy the way it should be, look for synergies. And Greece, as Russell mentioned, has a very talented and well-educated youth. And unfortunately, they are being stigmatized at the moment with this label of coming from a country that is corrupt, that where people don't work hard and don't have skills. And that's a problem, whether they stay here or whether they go abroad. And my fear is that Greece as a country is being tarnished. It's gaining a reputation that will take decades for it to change, regardless of whether it survives through this crisis or not.
Russell Shorto, quickly, we need to go to a break, and we'll come back, of course, let you talk further. But you did find, you said, success stories, including one case where there's a couple of brothers who are running a mattress company and distributing mattresses worldwide.
Yeah, well, one of the people I focused on was one of the owners of a company called Cocomat, which is if you live in Europe, if you live in other some parts of the world, you're familiar with them. They're just now starting in the U.S., but they've got 70 stores in, I think, 11 or 12 countries. As lately, they've been opening one shop a month in China. And they're doing it, from what I can tell, largely sort of the old-fashioned way. They told me they never take loans. They don't sort of reach beyond what they feel comfortable with. And they ride this wave of all-natural products and, to the extent that they can, Greek-made Greek products, cotton and so on. And so, you know, I thought it was interesting to look at, and most of their stores still are in Greece itself, which gives you a little pause, too, because these are not cheap products they have.
Okay. Again, Russell Shorto with the John Adams Institute in Amsterdam, a journalist who wrote extensively about what's going on in Greece and the way Greek people are living in the New York Times Magazine. We're going to take a very brief break on Reporter's Notebook, GOP Candidates and the Threat of War in Iran. Back in a moment with To the Point.
Subscribe to the To the Point podcast at kcrw.com or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find To the Point on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
Warren Ollie back with To the Point, talking today about Greece, a country with no good choices from an economic standpoint. One more question before we go to our next guest, to Russell Shorto, who wrote again in the New York Times about his extensive travels in Greece and his examination of the way people were living. Even though there's the Cocomat company doing well, the economy is again in its fifth year of recession with a 7% decline last year. What's going to be left if it continues in this direction, if in fact the austerity measures don't renew the economy in any significant way? What's Greece going to look like in 2 years, 5 years?
Well, one of the really troubling trends, which is kind of just under the radar, is while all this has been going on with the Troika and the Greek government debating things, other entities have been basically buying up pieces of the country, pieces of the infrastructure. The Chinese has taken control of the Piraeus, the main harbor, and plan to use it as a shipping conduit into Europe. The nation of Qatar has been in discussions to set up basically its own tourism business within Greece. So you would go to Greece to do the sun and lie on the beach, and it would be a Qatar company that's that you're doing business with. Other European concerns have been buying up parts of Greek islands to build retirement homes on. So, as one Greek economist said to me, that these other entities are basically kind of carving up the carcass of, so then the question is, 5 years from now, what is Greece? Is it sort of, is Greece a word that you put in quotation marks? You know, because if it doesn't have, if the people are, the young people are leaving, and your society is caving in, and if other entities are carving it up, then what how much is left to sustain it?
Russell Shordow with the John Adams Institute in Amsterdam. Charles Wiplas is an international economist and director of the International Center for Money and Banking Studies. Good to have you on our program.
Hello, how are you?
What can you tell us about how Greece got into this situation, and do you think that the nightmare scenario is likely, as we heard it described earlier by Nick Malkoutsis, and that is that Greece has to leave the eurozone, has to go back to the drachma?
No, I don't think so. It would be a total disaster, as was explained before. I think what Greece needs to do is to default on its debt. Right now, the debt reduction program has been masterminded by the countries that where the big banks that are creditors to Greece are located. And the last plan we had just 2 days ago was designed to protect the German and French banks and not to protect Greece. And that's the pattern since the very beginning of the crisis. Greece has been sort of pushed into a position where it accepts plans that are designed to protect the French and the German banks at the expense of Greece. That's a total shame. I don't quite understand why the Greek government has been so willing to get pushed around. And that has got to stop. It will stop. The plan that was just adopted is not going to work. And eventually there will be a serious default by the Greek government. But we are not there. Meanwhile, the other Europeans are forcing Greece into austerity programs that have two effects. One is to make the recession worse, and two is to make it impossible for the government to balance its books. So it's clearly the wrong direction. The reason why it's done is very clear. The reason why the Greeks are accepting that is less clear to me. But it will happen eventually, and the sooner the better.
What choice do they have if they need to get loans from other countries that are forcing them into this situation?
Well, that's true. They are being forced, but early on, now it's too late, but early on they should have never accepted to be bailed out by the other Europeans. They should have gone straight to the IMF, and the IMF would have managed the Greek situation like it's managed tens and tens of similar situations in the past. The problem is that the other European countries have gotten in the way, and the other European countries are very, very much keen to protect their own interests related to Greece. And that's been the, if you want, the original sin of this crisis.
Charles Wiplas with the International Center for Money and Banking Studies. Jennifer McEwen is a senior economic capitalist, a senior European economist at Capital Economics in London. Excuse me for bungling that one. Jennifer, it's good to have you on our program, and thanks for joining us.
Hello, Warren. You're welcome.
It's my understanding that you're less sanguine about Greece being pushed out of the eurozone. Tell us why.
Well, I think that I agree with a lot of what your previous guests have just said, but I think, unlike many of them, that actually Greece is likely to end up leaving the eurozone, and that's probably going to end up being the lesser of two evils for it. The bailout that's been put in place at the moment is already based on very extreme austerity measures, as your other guests have explained. But what it's also based on is a very sanguine outlook for the economy. It assumes that that Greek GDP is going to be pretty much unchanged over the next years, which would be a massive turnaround from what's happened lately. I think what's much more likely to happen is that Greece will remain in recession, in a very deep recession, and that's going to mean that in order to meet the targets that the Troika has set for Greece, it's going to need even more austerity than we've already seen. I just don't think that that's going to be possible. And I think that the end result of this is going to be either that Greece chooses to leave the Eurozone or that it is forced out. Yes, that will be very painful, but I don't think it will be quite as painful as the situation in which Greece stays in, carries on with these austerity measures, and isn't able to devalue its currency, and therefore ends up with years and years of internal devaluation, that's to say falling wages and falling prices.
What would be the consequences for the euro countries, the other countries in the eurozone, if in fact Greece were to leave?
Well, that would depend on just how it was done. Banks would need to be insulated, and I think perhaps more importantly, the other eurozone economies would need to do all that they could to ensure that. That there wasn't contagion to the likes of Portugal and other economies that are deemed at risk. They would need to try and support those economies because otherwise, there would be a general feeling in markets and elsewhere that the likes of Portugal and Ireland would end up leaving too. And if that feeling became prevalent, then they could end up being forced out just by increases in their bond yields and just general market sentiment. So I think that. If Greece were to leave, then probably a lot more money would need to go to Portugal. There would need to be very clear schemes that meant that the other peripheral economies could stay in the eurozone. And perhaps even more importantly, they would need to be very careful that this contagion didn't spread to the much larger economies like Spain and Italy.
Again, Charles Wieplaz, back to you at the International Center for Money and Banking Studies. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think a number of people who never believed in the European Monetary Union are looking forward to Greece to leave. That can happen, but it will happen for political reason when there is so much despair in Greece that the Greeks themselves will want to leave. The latest public opinion polls indicate that more than 70% of the Greeks want to stay inside the eurozone. And that's good economics. Leaving the eurozone would do nothing good for Greece. You have to realize that every single contract in Greece, the rent you pay, the loan you took from your bank, they're all in euros. If Greece were to leave, these contracts will basically break up. We had a little taste of that in Argentina in 2001. It was total pandemonium. That wouldn't help. The other story that we hear is that Greece is not competitive. That's wrong. It's based on faulty analysis of the facts. And anyway, Greek salaries have gone down by 10 to 15% since the beginning of the crisis. So that wouldn't help in anything. The Greeks don't need a devaluation. They just need to be able to carry on with normal life, which is prevented by the austerity policies that are imposed upon them. The other point is that a number of people say when Greece will default, it will have to leave the euro area. I don't see any reason. Just imagine that California defaults on its debt. Nobody would even start thinking about California leave the dollar area. So that's all. There's no clear link between there. It's not a solution for Greece to leave. What Greece needs to do is to return to growth. That means stopping the austerity measures. And what Greece needs to have is to have a big reduction of its huge debt that it built up for no good reason over the last 20 years.
Jennifer McKeon, do you agree that austerity is the wrong way to go, that it would be better, in fact, to go in the other direction, as Mr. Wieplaz says?
Yes, I do agree that austerity is the wrong way to go for Greece. It's already been done. There have been years of austerity in Greece, and it's only making the situation worse. And I think, as I mentioned earlier, it's just going to get worse and worse. There's going to be more and more austerity under current plans. So I do think that's the wrong way to go, and it has to be stopped. And I agree with Charles that Greece needs to write off much more of its debt. But I do think that there's something to be said for leaving the eurozone and devaluing, because that's a possible source of growth for Greece. I think that by devaluing its currency, it could export more, It could get more out of any kind of global recovery that we do see, any global demand that is there. And I think that's one way forward. Yes, leaving will be extremely painful, but I think not as painful as the alternative.
You mentioned a contagion, that one of the words that is the most fearsome to people elsewhere in Europe and also in the United States. Tell us to what extent this country might be affected.
Well, it is possible. We've already seen, I think, some effect on the United States in that prior to the financial crisis, there would have been no thought of the United States being downgraded. And as it's turned out, I think there probably has been some kind of contagion, with people becoming concerned about defaults in developed economies where previously that wouldn't have been seen as feasible. Attention does shift to even the biggest economies in the world, and that doesn't mean that people are concerned about outright default, but much higher up the rating scale, there do start to be concerns that maybe those ratings shouldn't be quite as high as they are.
So, Mr. Wiplas, how do you see the impact on the United States?
Well, Greece is very small. So Greece alone is no problem. The problem is once Greece, as I expect, will default, fairly soon afterwards Portugal will default, and Portugal too is pretty small. But then the pressure will shift to Italy, which has been stuck with a high debt for the last 10 years. The Italians are very proud that the debt hasn't increased, but they forget to tell us it hasn't decreased either. So Italy is fodder for the following default. Now, Italy is big, and its debt is big. So when Italy defaults on top of the others, you will see a massive, an incredible banking crisis, much bigger than what we saw with Lehman's brother. Then the U.S. will feel the pinch. So the problem is not immediate. It's not Greece. It's not even Portugal. It's further down the road. It's Italy. And by the way, if Greece were to leave the euro area, God forbid, then the market would immediately turn their attention to Portugal, and then immediately to Italy, and the whole nightmare scenario would happen even faster. But that's the connection. The connection is the banking system. It's banks around the world, huge banks, large banks that have lent a lot of money to the Italian government and to the Spanish government. And when these banks start shaking, then the crisis will be a global crisis.
Now let's get back to Greece and our first guest, Nick Malkoutsis, who's deputy editor of the English edition of Katamitani, the national Greek newspaper. Earlier, Mr. Wiplas said he didn't understand why it was that the Greek government allowed itself to be pushed around by these other countries who are, in fact, enforcing these difficult choices on Greece in order to protect German and French banks, as he put it. If that's the case, the question to you would be, why is Greece allowing itself to be pushed around?
Well, I think that's a question a lot of Greeks are asking, too, and I'm not sure anyone really has the answer, apart from saying that the amateur nature of this country's politicians has been revealed on a global scale. And just to give you an indication, Greece, according to the EU and IMF projections, will go through a period of austerity until 2020. It will have the biggest debt reduction the world has ever known in this current swap that's being discussed. It will have two huge bailouts. And at the end of all that, in 2020, it's if everything goes according to plan and the best case scenario, it will have about 120% of GDP debt. Well, that's exactly what it had when it entered this crisis. So what a lot of people are asking is, why didn't we tackle this in a different way? And we don't have the answers from the Greek political system, but what we're guessing is that they were completely caught unawares. They were unprepared. They handled this in an unprofessional matter. They were caught up in their own party politics. They committed to things they knew that Greece couldn't deliver, certainly in terms of structural reforms, and they accepted fiscal targets that simply compounded the problem.
But 70% of the people want to stay with the euro. Why is that?
Well, you know, there's definitely a majority. Depends which polls you read, and I would say that the number is coming down, although there is still a strong majority in favor of the euro. And I think it's really because they see it as an anchor in modern Western Europe, progressive Europe. There is a fear here that if we go back to the drachma, two things will occur. One, the political system that led Greece to this point will be rejuvenated. It's in a state of decay, and it's ready to crumble now. If we go back to the drachma, they will have control of the printing presses, they will have control of fiscal policy, and they will be able to go back to doing the things that they've done, which is, for instance, to hand out public sector jobs to people who vote for them, to hand out public contracts to people that they like and do business with, and so on. And the other fear is that simply it will signal a moment in Greece where everyone can just give up. Greece is going through this very, very tough phase of almost a rebirth to try and put right a lot of the wrongs that were done in the past. And the fear is that if we go back to the drachma, that process will be abandoned completely. And in the end, Greece will end up in a much worse position than anyone could have ever imagined.
Well, we're going to have to leave it on that grim note. Thank you all very much for being on our program today. Nick Malkoutsis, again, at Katamedani, the newspaper in Greece. He also blogs at Inside Greece. Russell Shorto, whom we heard in our first half of our program and a little bit in the second half as well, director of the John Adams Institute in Amsterdam, wrote extensively about the way Greeks live now in the New York Times Magazine. Charles Wiplas, international economist, director of the International Center for Money and Banking Studies. Thanks to you. And Jennifer McKeown, senior European economist at Capital Economics in London. Good to have all of you on our program, grim as the news may be. Last night's televised debate may be the last of its kind before the Republican presidential nomination has been decided. For all their apparent differences, all but one of the candidates, though, do agree on one thing: the threat of force to stop Iran from getting an atom bomb. Back in a moment with To the Point.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to_the_point_KCRW.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. In last night's Republican presidential debate, all the candidates tried to outdo each other with appeals to the party's most conservative voters. All but Ron Paul called for military action to preempt Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. We'll start with Newt Gingrich.
If you think a madman is about to have nuclear weapons and you think that madman is going to use those nuclear weapons, then you have an absolute moral obligation to defend the lives of your people by eliminating the capacity to get nuclear weapons.
We must not allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon. If they do, the world changes, America will be at risk, and someday nuclear weaponry will be used.
You want a leader who will take them on, I'll do that.
The neoconservatives who now want us to be in serious want us to go to Iran and have another war. And we don't have the money. We're already, today, gasoline hit $6 a gallon in Florida. And we don't have the money.
You heard the voices of Newt Gingrich, Mitt Romney, Rick Santorum, and finally Ron Paul, who also mentioned the prospect of using force in Syria to stop its attacks on its own people. Ori Friedman is associate editor at Foreign Policy Magazine. It's good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren. Good to be here.
Is the conversation about foreign policy amongst the Republicans getting tougher and tougher, as it sounds from those sound bites we just heard?
Yes. You know, the conversation on Iran has always been tough, but it's only ratcheting up as the Republicans try to distinguish themselves from President Obama. In President Obama's State of the Union address, he said the military option against Iran was on the table, which is kind of diplomatic jargon for saying that it hasn't been dismissed. So the onus now goes to the Republicans to say how they differ from Obama. And so Mitt Romney last night said, we need to let Iran know that the military option isn't just on the table, but in our hand, which is basically saying that, you know, we are prepared to use military force, and this needs to be made clear to Tehran. And President Obama hasn't done a good enough job in articulating that to Iran's leaders. On Syria, there's also, you know, the real news in last night's debate was that there was an explicit question about how the candidates would respond to the violence in Syria. And I think that was prompted by the fact that the news of late has just been very, very dire coming out of Syria with an assault on homes and a general inability to resolve the conflict as it goes from a kind of peaceful uprising to an armed rebellion against a government that seems intent on continuing its crackdown.
You've written about Newt Gingrich talking about covert operations in Syria. Do the other candidates like that idea?
Some candidates have spoken about covert ops in, for example, Mitt Romney and Santorum have talked about covert ops in Iran. And Rick Santorum has actually advocated designating scientists as enemy combatants in the U.S. confrontation with Iran. But only Newt Gingrich has really talked about covert ops in many places. He's talked about it in Cuba to nonviolently overthrow the Castro regime. He's talked about it in Pakistan to get information that we can't get from an untrustworthy Pakistani spy agency. And he's talked about it in Libya as an alternative to President Obama's approach there. So he really seems to be an advocate of this. And in fact, in 1995, he spearheaded legislation in Congress to do a $20 million program, a covert program in Iran. And it was controversial at the time because he had worked so hard on it and been so vocal about it that it leaked to the press, to Iranian leaders and people, and the CIA, which was forced to implement it, had to say, you know, our cover's been blown. How are we supposed to implement this effectively?
What do the other candidates say to Ron Paul when he says that we can't afford to do anything more overseas than we already are? I made the point last night that we're fixing roads in Afghanistan when roads in the United States are falling apart.
Yes, that has been Ron Paul's argument again with Syria, with Iran. And what's interesting is, you know, debt, the national debt and government spending is a big issue for the Republicans, and they talk a lot about making government smaller, but not when it comes to a whatever cost it would take to launch a strike on Iran if need be. And I think that's because, you know, their argument has been, financial questions aside, Iran, a world with Iran, a nuclear Iran, is a world that we don't want to have. Rick Santorum, in fact, has warned voters in Missouri, in South Carolina, in Florida, in North Dakota, that they are not safe if Iran has a nuclear weapon, that they could attack the United States, that it's an existential threat to Israel. And so they feel that, you know, have seemed to suggest that even though they are generally fiscal conservatives, that the United States has no option but to launch a military campaign, if need be, to prevent a nuclear Iran.
Ori Friedman, again, associate editor at Foreign Policy Magazine. Scott Clement is polling analyst at The Washington Post. Scott Clement, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
How does all this go down, as far as you can tell, with American voters? Are they fearful that if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, the United States might be attacked? Do they want to see action, covert or otherwise, in Syria? Or can you tell?
Well, nearly 9 in 10 Americans view Iran's nuclear efforts as a serious threat to national security. And this is in polling last year, before the recent build-up and heightened rhetoric. But polls right now are showing very divergent findings on whether military action should be taken now. A CNN poll this month showed just 17% of Americans saying that we need military action right now. But a similarly timed Pew survey showed Americans saying by 2-1 that it's more important to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons, even if it takes military action. I think what's helping to color this is that while people are very afraid of the idea of a nuclear Iran, they're also not eager to join another conflict. And this is also colored by the fact that they're not too confident that sanctions and economic efforts will be effective.
Are they worried, in addition to effectiveness, about the cost of conflict?
Well, polls haven't really tried to measure that. But I think we know from the past decade that the time and cost efforts and human costs of war can really weigh down on wars. The Iraq War was quite popular just as we were invading, but it became increasingly unpopular. And at this point, or late last year, when Obama finally said he would move things out of the war there, it was a remarkably popular move.
How are American voters feeling right now about Afghanistan?
Afghanistan has very mixed reviews. Americans aren't 100% either way on whether it's been worth the cost or not, but they're generally supportive of removing troops from Afghanistan.
Okay, and quickly back to Uri Friedman. Has Afghanistan really been discussed very much by the Republican candidates?
It was not mentioned at all in last night's debate. Now, last night's debate was not a foreign policy debate, so that should be said, but it was, hasn't been mentioned. Earlier, there was talk of how, you know, Mitt Romney said he didn't like Obama's withdrawal plan because he would have consulted with military commanders more and taken their advice. There's been talk about it being too precipitous. But that was really in the early stages of the debate, and I think, you know, there's not much, I don't think the Republican candidates feel there's as much that they can talk about there that really puts a wedge between them and Obama than issues like Iran.
Okay. Uri Friedman at Foreign Policy Magazine, Scott Clement with the Washington Post, polling analyst there. I thank you both very much for being on our program.
Thank you.
Producers of To the Point are Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Sonia Guy, Anna Scott, and Caitlin Chamberg. Our technical director is Mike Newport. Managing producer is Karen Radziner. I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.